Ron Pattinson joins me this week to discuss historical beer brewing in post-war Britain. This is Beersmith Podcast number 176.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 176, and it's late August 2018. This week, Ron Pattinson joins me to discuss historical beers in the post-war period. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download your recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and set updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available for download, and also the new mobile version is out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit, juice, and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Ron Pattinson. Ron is an expert in historical beer brewing and runs a blog called Shut Up About Barclay Perkins at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Ron, it's great to have you on the show. I think this is your third or fourth time, right?
Yeah, I think this is time number three now. So, I'm getting quite used to it.
So, I understand you've been working on a number of mini books. That's your latest project, right?
Yeah, I call them mini books. They're not really that mini. I mean, the last one was, I think, 350 pages. So it's not really what you could call small.
So not exactly a comic book, huh?
No, not exactly. So I meant to bash it out a bit quicker than I did do, but no, I'm quite pleased with it. I'm pretty sure it's a completely uncommercial topic, but, you know, what do I care? I don't make a living out of this, so I can write about what the hell I want.
So how many books have you done so far?
I've actually genuinely lost count. I think this was number 30-odd in the series, 30-something.
30-something. I saw you had a lot of Roman numerals after it there.
Yeah, I mean, some of them haven't ever been officially published, so I've got a couple that are, I've only ever done privately, a couple that aren't finished. So there's some numbers in the series which don't really, which haven't been published yet. But the books do exist in every case. So, but they might not be completely finished.
So are you self-publishing these? Are you publishing them online?
I self-publish them just because I can't be bothered to go through the trouble of getting a publisher for most of them, to be honest. I probably should try harder, but it's quite nice to just have complete control. And I do like being able to write exactly the books I want to write, not books that I'm trying to please some publisher with, but exactly the book that I want to write. So this one, it's something that particularly interested me. Immediate post-war British beer, it's the time when the sort of beer that I knew when I was growing up was formed. And so for me, it's particularly fascinating. So the book basically stops about the time when I started drinking, ironically. So,
yeah, your latest book is called Austerity. And yeah. It features, of course, post-World War II beers, right? Primarily in Britain, right?
exclusively in Britain, really. It's really about British beer in that period. I mean, I've got some details of some imported beers, but and I think I might have even thrown in a Heineken recipe now I think about it. But basically, it's about British beer, or beer that was available in Britain in that period.
So why'd you decide to call it Austerity?
Because I wanted to have a one-word title with an exclamation mark in it. And it was originally going to be called Victory. And then I sort of wrote another book called Victory that I didn't really properly publish, but I had done a copy of just for one person because he won a competition. So I thought, well, I didn't really want to reuse that name then, so I just came up with Austerity. But it does reflect really a lot of what the book's about the fact that the post-war period was very difficult, that it was certainly for the first 8 or 9 years really dominated by austerity, a shortage of everything. And so I thought it was a fairly good title. And what the book's really about is starting off with this really austere period where there's shortages of everything and gradually growing into the period of the early 60s when suddenly things are getting much better and people are generally more optimistic. So it's like a transformation that you have coming out of the really dull post-war years and then getting into the 60s when everything becomes more exciting.
So what were some of the major trends and themes we see coming out of, let's talk about immediately after World War II.
Immediately after World War II, what you see is beer strengths getting even weaker because there's still loads and loads of restrictions. So the worst years were probably 1947, 1948, but that reflects things generally. I mean, people may not realize in the United States, but rationing went on in Britain until the mid-1950s, food rationing. And in some cases, the rations actually fell after the end of the war because things were very hard in Britain. The pound wasn't a hard currency. So if you wanted to import anything, you had to have dollars. And dollars were in very short supply. And so it was very restricted as to what you could import. And I've come across things of breweries who wanted to import bottling machinery from somewhere else, and they couldn't because they couldn't get hold of the dollars. So it's a really big problem for post-war breweries. Lots of them had been damaged during the war. Lots of them had had virtually no investment during the 1920s and 30s. So there was lots of work that needed to be done, but they weren't allowed to do it because the materials weren't there, or they couldn't import materials, or they weren't allowed building permits. If you wanted to build anything in the immediate post-war years, you had to get permission to do it because there was a huge shortage of building materials. And just like during the war, they were directed towards the things that people thought were the most important. And breweries often came quite low down the list. So what you had is, this is why one of the reasons why so many breweries sold up in the mid-1950s, it's because lots of them hadn't, either through neglect or just because they weren't able to, hadn't had any investment for like 20 or 30 years, and lots of them were falling down. And they got to the point where either they had to invest serious money in them if they wanted to continue, or they sold up, and lots of them just sold up. So it had a big effect on the brewing industry and the structure of it, that you see an awful lot of the small family-owned businesses where the family just calls it a day because they aren't interested in brewing anymore. They might not even be connected with the day-to-day running of the brewery. And if people come and say, well, you're going to have to put all this money in to keep the brewery going, they just say, well, no. Let's just call it a day and get our money out.
So you had rationing in food. You said you had rationing in building materials were in short supply. I assume ingredients were probably hard to come by as well, right?
Yes, and there were restrictions on what you were allowed to use. So, I mean, one of the classic things is, if you look in the book, you can see all these recipes from the late 1940s where they've all got flaked barley in them. Now, flaked barley is not something that people generally used in Britain. And it was something they were forced to do during the war. And it was a replacement for flaked corn, which had to be imported because people didn't grow corn in Britain at the time. And what they decided during the war was they hugely boosted barley production. And as a replacement adjunct, they decided that flaked barley was a good idea. And also it was to do with the fact that producing flaked barley that you could use in brewing used less energy than producing malt. And so they basically forced brewers to use it. So you find people like Whitbread, who usually didn't use any adjuncts at all, during the later war years in the 1940s, they're putting flaked barley into their beer. It's not a voluntary choice. They've been forced to do it. And then what you see in the early 1950s is most of the breweries go back to using flaked maize, flaked corn, or in the case of Whitbread, to stop using it altogether and just go back to brewing from barley and sugar.
But of course, flaked barley is not really a substitute for flake. I mean, corn is a thinning agent, really, to a large degree, and barley is a thickening agent, right? To some degree?
Well, to some degree. I mean, to be honest, people have funny ideas about adjuncts. And I think it mostly comes from people, especially in the States, associating adjuncts with these really horrible American adjunct lagers, as they're called. But there's nothing wrong with using maize, corn. I mean, and I've had plenty of beers, especially things that are the lighter type of English bitter, things like the typical AKs, where they might have 15% maize, and it makes a really nice light-bodied beer. It's a beer that's not meant to be thick and heavy. It's meant to be something that's easy drinking. And it was used specifically for that purpose, the same way that sugar was used in the classy pale ales. So things like Bass and Allsops, the really top class expensive pale ales, they would have in the 19th century 15% sugar in them because they wanted to have a really pale color and a really light body. And they got that through using partly sugar in the grist. So the whole idea that, oh, you know, all these adjuncts are bad and they're messing up the beer and they're making it worse is not necessarily the case. People use these things in very specific ways. They weren't stupid. They were aiming at something and they were using the ingredients they could get to achieve that aim.
And did you have shortages in other ingredients like hops and so on?
Well, what you see happen with hops is that the foreign hops disappear. So basically what happens during World War II is Britain becomes self-sufficient in brewing ingredients, amazingly for like the first time in probably 100 years. So really since back in the 1840s. So it's a really big deal because they hugely increase barley production. I mean, it goes up like tenfold, though obviously not all of that was intended for beer. Some of that's for whiskey, and also some of it's for animal feed, and some of it was for the bread that they had during the war, which had partly barley in it. So they hugely increased that. They needed fewer hops because the beer had got weaker. And so they could grow enough hops. And so you see American ingredients disappear from British beer. So whereas if you look at in 1914, American hops, Californian barley had been really important in British beer. And then in between the wars, not so much the American hops, but the American barley, because people liked it because it was low in nitrogen. They thought that they needed to have it in their mash. So you see the typical thing is that they'll always have like 15% American barley in the base malt. So malt made from American barley, not American malt, because they'd always malt it in the UK. And then that disappears after World War II. And so you see very few foreign ingredients. What you mostly see are things like SARS hops appear just after the end of the war, because obviously they'd stopped brewing in Central Europe about 1944. And so you see the 1944 and 1945 crop turning up in British beer after the war, presumably because they got loads of these hops that they couldn't sell. And so they dumped them on the British market for a cheap price because people actually liked SARS hops. But in general, Britain was pretty much self-sufficient in brewing ingredients after the war.
And how did things change when the economy started picking up in the 50s and 60s?
Well, what you see is in the 50s, as people start getting better off. Well, the funny thing is that beer production generally went down. All through the 50s, it was declining. It only started going back up again in 1959 when they cut the tax. But between 1950 and 1959, it declined, the amount of beer produced in the UK. So even though when the economy picked up, people didn't immediately start drinking beer again because it was still relatively expensive. But what you do see is that beer is getting stronger up to a certain point. So it gets back. In terms of original gravity, what you see is that the nadir was, I think, 47 and 48 when it was 1032. And then it gets back to 1037 about 1951 or 52. And then it stays there at that level until the 1970s. So it doesn't change at all. So it's year on year average gravity. It might be 1036.9 one year, 1037.5 another, but it's basically the same level for over 20 years. So you see that the strength bounces back to a certain extent, and then it finds a new equilibrium, and it basically stays there. So that's when you've got beers that are the strength that modern British beer is. So ordinary bitter about 3.6, 3.7%, mild 3.2, best bitter 4.2, something like that. So you've basically got the modern style strengths.
Right, right. So, I mean, does the economy in general? You've studied way back, quite a long while back in British history. Does the economy generally drive the brewing significantly?
Yes.
Yeah, I figured.
Of course. And taxation. So, yeah.
That was actually my next question, because you had mentioned taxation just a minute ago. How does the tax policy drive things during this entire period?
Well, it encourages it. It's the weird thing that at a certain point in the 1950s, they wanted to try and actually boost beer production. And so you see there were some genuine tax cuts, which in Britain in the 20th century, in terms of beer, is incredibly rare, where they cut the tax. Normally, they just didn't put it up. And so they did make a fairly significant cut in 1959. And you see beer consumption immediately go up. And it's also a time where you've got younger people with more money than they'd probably had before, which could have contributed something to it. But then you see beer production goes up for the rest of the 60s, pretty much. But it does seem to have been spurred initially by a tax cut, which made beer slightly cheaper.
And how did they tax beer? Was it taxed on the barrel, or was it taxed by alcohol volume?
No, it was taxed on the standard barrel.
Okay.
So you had a rate of tax for something that is called a standard barrel. So a standard barrel is 36 imperial gallons at a gravity of 1055. And so the tax was set on that. So you'd convert. So if you had two barrels of beer of 1027.5, that would be one standard barrel. So it'd be two bulk barrels, but one standard barrel.
Interesting. So it's done on original gravity as well then, huh?
Yeah. So it's done on original gravity. And that was up until the late 1970s when they changed, I think it was 79, when they changed it to being on ABV. But this is the original gravity of the wort before it's fermented. So the excise would check when the beer went into the fermenters.
Interesting. And, are they taxing ingredients as well, or are they not?
No, it's purely on the beer. So there's no, I mean, this is the system they'd had before 1880, was that they taxed mostly malt, some of the time hops as well, but mostly malt they taxed. Partly because having a system like they later did would have been impractical because there were too many breweries. I mean, if you see the number of breweries that there were in Britain before 1880, it's just crazy. It's like you're talking in the tens of thousands.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, what about imports? How do they affect the British beer scene? Do we start to see more imports as we get into the 60s or not?
No, mostly imports are fairly steady, and it mostly consists of lager beer coming from the continent.
Well, I mean, so, you mentioned they got close to zero in the post-World War II period, right?
Yeah, well, obviously during the war. Well, no, imports never dried up during World War II for one good reason.
What's that?
Guinness.
Guinness, okay.
Oh, you had. I found this fascinating stuff from World War II where Guinness was this whole negotiating thing that they had between the Irish and the British government. So the Irish were short of wheat for making bread. And they said to the British that unless you give us wheat and barley, we're not going to export any Guinness to Northern Ireland anymore. And because Northern Ireland was like 90% dependent on Guinness for its beer, the British government gave in. So it was like this huge negotiation, all based around Guinness and food supplies. It's a really weird story.
Yeah, it's very interesting going to Ireland. Yeah, I went to Ireland and I tried to order a beer other than a Guinness, and he said, no, you want a Guinness. So that was kind of how it went. So they're still importing a lot of Guinness, apparently. And then you mentioned they're starting to get continental beers as well as we get into the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, well, no, I mean, when you say in all the post-war period, the bulk of it that's coming in, the largest source country was Denmark. And when I look at some of the other things, all the Whitbread Gravity book, where I've got these analyses of beer on sale in Britain, then you see loads of examples of Tuborg and Carlsberg lager. So obviously a lot of it was that. And then you've got quite a bit of beer from Holland as well. So you've got Heineken coming in. I already knew that about Heineken because I've looked at their brewing records from the 50s and I've seen the special beer that they brewed for Britain, because they brewed a particularly weak one for the UK market. Because their normal beer is 5% and they had one that was like 3.2% for the UK. And if you read the Heineken brewery history, they weren't very happy about brewing that beer. And they thought it seems like they thought themselves it was rubbish. But they were saying, oh, well, we have to brew that for the UK market because that's the strength and the price that people expect. And we can't brew a stronger beer because we won't be able to sell it.
Mm. Well, who are the big domestic beer producers during the period? I assume there was some consolidation going on during this period as well, right?
Well, this is when you have the whole thing that was triggered off by Eddie Taylor, a Canadian who was responsible for Carling Black Label. And he sort of got drawn into the UK beer market and based around this brewery in Yorkshire, started trying to put together a national group, which is what he'd already done in Canada. And he seems to have triggered off loads of other people to start doing the same thing. So basically you get this rush to consolidate. Everyone's afraid that they're going to get left out, or that there's all these other breweries are going to club together and they're going to be too small to compete with them. So you get this real sort of frenzy in the between, like, say, 55 and 65. And you get what were the brewing groups that I knew when I was a kid, which is normally called the Big Six. So these were six big brewing companies, but between them owned something like 65, 70% of the pubs. So really dominated the beer market. And so these were people like, I mean, everyone's heard of Bass. So the biggest brewing group was Bass Charrington, which Charrington being a London brewery, but they were a conglomeration of all sorts of different ones. Whitbread, they were one of the big players. They sort of started off slow and then they bought up a whole load of other breweries in quite a crafty way by pretending to protect them. It was quite sneaky what Whitbread did, actually. And then you get, people like Watney, who everyone hates. but I've got some good Watney's recipes. Well, if you see the way they brewed, it's no wonder they had a bad reputation. Because the beers are perfectly fine as they brew them. And then what they do, at the end of primary fermentation, they put 15% into them. So,
no, literally. What do you mean by that?
Well, returned beer, the bottom of things, stuff left in pipes, all the sort of stray bits of beer that they had around the brewery. So honestly, returned beer that they pasteurize and then throw into the new beer. But 15% of most of their beers was this sort of what they called recycled beer.
So kind of like brewing waste maybe, right?
Well, yeah, but the thing about Ullage was they got that tax-free. Because when it came back to the brewery, they could reclaim the duty that they paid on it. And then they got this stuff that had got alcohol in it that they'd effectively not paid any tax on. So it was incredibly attractive for a brewery that was trying to squeeze the last penny out of every pint to use this stuff. But obviously, it's not going to do your beer quality any good.
Well, that actually brings me to my next question, which is, can you talk about some of the brewing techniques and equipment used during the period? And let's start with the post-World War II period, which is, very austere, obviously.
Well, nothing changed initially because they didn't have any money to change anything. So all the no breweries could invest till probably about 53, 54. They were lumbered with what they had. What lots of breweries would have loved to have done would be to invest in their bottling halls, because bottling was where there was a lot more money to be made, and that's where all the growth was in the market. But they didn't have the money to be able to do that. So basically, the initial years, people just carried on the way they were. And then what you see in the mid-50s, then you see once people are breweries can invest, then lots of them put a lot of money into bottling and push their bottled products. And then they also get the idea of, well, let's have a draft product that's like bottled beer. And then they come up with keg beer. And so you see in the late 50s, all these keg beers appearing. So it's not just the big breweries, it's even quite small breweries start producing keg beers, which are usually something that claims to be a premium bitter. Often they're not that strong. They sell at a premium price, and there must be a market for them because pretty much every brewery comes up with one. And so this is the big growth market in the late 1950s. And what often you'd hear brewery professionals describe keg beer as is it's basically like bottled beer because it's been brewery conditioned, it's controlled. And brewers liked it, a lot of them, because they weren't dependent anymore on whatever the landlord did in the pub, like with cask beer, that they could be fairly sure, as was the case with bottled beer, that the beer would get to the customer in the same state as it left the brewery. The fact that it might have tasted when it left the brewery anyway was sort of seems to have gone by them. Whereas, yeah, you had a guarantee it was always going to taste the same, but if it was always going to taste equally, then you hadn't really got anywhere.
Are they distributing this primarily through public houses too? I know they have a unique system in Britain where they distribute a lot of the beer through the houses that are owned.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about the post-war period, I mean, the vast majority of pubs were owned by breweries.
Right, right. So the breweries own the pub and they only distribute their beers primarily, right?
Mostly that was the case. There were some exceptions. So every pub would sell bottled Guinness, and a lot of pubs would sell bottled Bass, and some would sell even draft Bass. But other than that, yeah, other than a few really specialist niche beers or ones with really good reputations, no, they'd only sell their own beers. I mean, it's like if you go to a Sam Smith's pub nowadays, they are the most extreme example of tight houses in that everything is branded Sam Smith's. So, I mean, everything. So all the spirits, all the wines, the crisps, everything. The brewery provides every single thing that they sell in the pub.
Well, what styles were produced during this period, and how did the styles evolve as we got from the 40s to the 50s to the 60s?
Well, what you've got is the beginning of the period, in terms of draft beer, it's mostly ordinary bitter and ordinary mild, and not much else because they couldn't really brew very much in the way of stronger beers. When you get into the 1950s, then you see beers like Fuller's London Pride appearing, where when people have got a bit more money and the restrictions on strength have been reduced, then breweries start coming up with stronger, mostly stronger pale ale, stronger draft bitters, because there's a market for those and they can make some money out of them. And so you see that you're getting quite a few of these beers. So Young Special appears at the same period. So you get these stronger bitters that are coming onto the market. There was some attempt to sell some stronger milds, but that didn't really take off. That Whitbread had a stronger thing they called 3X mild in the mid-1950s that only lasted a couple of years. But what you're seeing is that there's a general move away from mild to bitter because people have got more money and bitters associated with people who are better off. I read this great thing somewhere recently where someone was saying, oh, the darker the beer people drink, the poorer they are. Was what people thought in the 50s. So it was like an aspirational thing. So that's why you start seeing a move from mild to bitter, and also generational thing that young people tended to want to drink bitter rather than mild. And you've also got the move from draft beer to bottled beer. So it's really common in the 1950s for people to mix draft and bottled beer. So the typical mixes would be mild and brown ale, light ale, bottled light ale, and bitter. And so they're very common, and partly that's a reaction to poor beer quality. So people aren't that confident about the state of the draft beer, but they can't afford to drink just bottled beer, so they mix the two to try and get the best of both worlds. And that's a really common trend during the 1950s. And then you've got the growth of lager. So initially just a very much a niche thing, only produced by a handful of breweries in the UK. Between the wars, only 6 breweries in the UK brewed lager. It's a really tiny number.
Wow, that's really small, yeah.
Yeah. lots of people had lost loads of money trying to find lager breweries before World War One, and most people had been put off. And then you find in the late 1950s, suddenly you've got all these regional breweries, quite small ones. So people like Eldridge Pope, who were never of that big a brewery, brewing lager, mostly not very authentically, to be honest. Mostly they, I mean, I've seen the brewing records. They weren't using lager yeast and they were fermenting at like 60, 65 degrees. So it's a lager in name only, basically. But you see all these beers appearing. So lots and lots of quite small regional breweries. I mean, Elgood's were brewing a lager. Elgood's, they only have 35 pubs. They're tiny. And they were brewing a lager in the early 1960s. So you see that obviously this was something people were trying to get into. And then the large brands took over and all these, all the ones from the regional and local breweries, all their lager brands disappeared. And I don't know if any of them still exist.
And then you also mentioned there's a big push to premium brands as we got into the late 50s and 60s, right, when the economy started picking up.
Yeah, I mean, well, what you also get is all these, well, the origins of some of the keg bitters were these classy bottled pale ales. So things like Double Diamond and Ben Truman started life as Burton pale ales. And then later on, they were taken from being just purely bottled beers to being keg beers, which were supposedly the same, but and supposedly premium beers, but they often didn't look very premium to me when I looked at the recipes but and the strengths. But yeah, people didn't know how strong anything was in those days, so it was difficult for people to make very rational judgments. I mean, you also get this thing, I mean, one of the other big things that spurs stuff on is the coronation in 53, when you get all these strong coronation beers brewed. So this was really the first time that people had brewed really strong beer after World War II. And some of the coronation beers actually lived on longer and became permanent beers. But it was also like the first time where you got beers of full strength. So you're getting beers that were 9, 10% alcohol being brewed again, whereas they haven't been for quite a long while.
Well, let's get into a little bit into the recipes. So you in the book, you feature a whole series of homebrew size recipes that are, kind of styled among beers from the period or based on beers from the period. Can you tell us what a typical English mild might look like immediately after World War II and then as we get farther in time? How it evolves a bit?
It's difficult to say. I mean, in 1947, an ordinary mild, you'd be lucky if it had a gravity much over 1027, and it might well have been under 3% ABV.
So a pretty light beer.
Yeah, very light beers. So you were lucky if they were 3% ABV. And then generally they go up a bit in strength. It varied from region. If you go to the West Midlands, where mild was popular, they were stronger there. There you've got ones that are 3.5-3.6% alcohol. But the southern ones tend to mostly be fairly weak, mostly under 3%. Well, I mean, one of the weird things is I found, because I've got so many analyses from different breweries, I've been able to do analyses based on region. And I could see regional differences in mild. And so the London ones were distinctly darker, more poorly attenuated, and lower in ABV than most of the ones from elsewhere. So they were dark, sweet beers. And you can see that they're just as the, because I've got enough to have a decent sample, and I can see that they are statistically different, the London ones. They're definitely a different style to the ones you get in most of the rest of the country. And that I found fascinating. And I'd heard that you had these regional differences in beers, and it was really interesting to be able to see it, especially in things like colour. There's really big differences in the colour in the different regions. That the London ones are a lot darker than the ones from most other parts of the UK. So,
interesting. And where other differences between different regions did you pick up?
A lot of the other stuff's fairly random. So, I mean, when you're looking in terms of the ingredients, I found a huge number of different ingredients that are being used. I don't know what most people expect a typical mild drifter to look like. And it's hard to say what a typical one is. Now I've looked at more of them. I would have said before that it'd be either pale or mild malt as a base, crystal malt, number three invert sugar, flake maize. Mm-hmm. But when I looked at them, there were loads that weren't like that. And so there's a surprising number of them that didn't have crystal malt in them, which I would have expected. And then even more surprising ones that didn't have number three invert sugar in them, because that's normally the way you'd get the color. And so you get some really interesting ones like Lee's Best Mild from the 1950s, which has, usually I'd say, dark mild doesn't have anything darker than crystal malt in it for the most part. And that's pretty much true of all the milds in the 1950s, apart from Lee's, where they put in like three or four different colored malts. So they have some really interesting dark mild grists, which are incredibly untypical. But most of the others, you rarely get any colored malt. There's a few that have got chocolate malt in, odd one that's got a bit of black malt, very occasionally some amber malt. But mostly the color is all coming from caramel and from number three invert sugar.
Interesting. And you mentioned they're mostly using domestic malts and domestic hops at this time because of restrictions and shortage.
Not just that, but just because Britain became self-sufficient during the war. So they didn't need to import anything anymore. And also, as I was saying earlier, in the immediate post-war years, if you wanted to import stuff, you needed hard currency.
Need money, yeah.
Yeah, and that was in short supply. So it was obviously much easier just to source all your ingredients locally.
Yeah, one thing I glossed over was yeast. And I think yeast is kind of an interesting story, isn't it?
Yeast's fun. If you want to know about yeast, you need to go to Harvey's Brewery.
So why is that?
Because of the crazy story they have about their yeast.
At this point, most breweries weren't using single strain yeast, right? They were just using whatever.
I think virtually none were using single strain yeast at this point. There might have been a few fanatics somewhere, but generally no. And that doesn't fit in with the way people pitched. You see what people did in Scotland. I mean, they all shared their yeast around. You see, in the brew records, it actually has a column to say where the yeast came from. And they're using yeast from all the other breweries in Edinburgh. The Edinburgh breweries are especially bad from this. So if you're doing that, using at various times the yeast from 12 other different breweries, how pure do you think that strain's going to be after a while?
So quite a bit of variation, I would think, right?
Well, I guess they just got some sort of common strain that had bits of everything in it. And I know that from breweries that are still using their strains from then, that there were normally two, three. Most of them probably didn't even know how many strains there were in there. I had this discussion with, I think it's Lars Marcus Garshol, one of the people who's been looking at the Norwegian beer, Norwegian farmhouse brewing, and he was saying, oh, when you look at the strains there, it depends which chemist you ask how many strains they identify in there. So it might be two or it might be 10, depending on how fussy they are about how many cells they are from the different yeasts. So even though people like Fuller's, they said they had three strains, that there might have actually been more than that in there, but just in small amounts. Adnams, they still use their two-strain yeast, which they've always had. I mean, Harvey's, what they do, they're a good example of people not understanding what was in their pitching yeast. Their yeast, they've been repitching it for 50 years. No, sorry, 60 years.
So probably all kinds of things in it, right?
Just repitching constantly for 60 years. I've seen their yeast management. They have buckets of yeast. That's how they do it. They just have buckets of yeast lying around in the brewery. And they have this stuff. This is what makes their Imperial Stout such a wonderful beer. I thought it had Brettanomyces in it. What it actually has is this stuff called Deboromyces, which is this weird yeast. The way it ferments their beer, when they put it into a tank, it does nothing for 6 months and then goes crazy. They didn't realize it was in their pitching strain. It's only when they started leaving a beer long enough for it to do anything that they noticed. And when you read about this strain of yeast, it's one, this really weird one that's really highly salt tolerant that you tend to get in river estuaries. And Harvey's is right next to a river estuary. So the chances are it's just stuff, it's obviously just wandered in from the river outside. And that's why they've got this thing there now in their yeast. But I mean, during the normal fermentation, it does nothing because it takes months to really take any hold. So you wouldn't realize it was there unless you were looking at your yeast in incredibly microbial level and really looking for anything else. So yeah, everyone had complicated strains and probably even more complicated strains than they realized. And lots of people did what Harvey's did, which is just they continually repitched. They didn't have the strains banked and regenerate them every time. They just kept repitching generation after generation after generation. I mean, it's amazing. When you hear what Harvey said, they say, oh, well, you know, sometimes it goes a bit strange, but it normally gets back to being okay again after a while. It's like an incredibly lackadaisical attitude to have for your yeast.
That's pretty interesting. You feature a whole bunch of homebrew-sized recipes. Can you just share maybe one of your favorites with us?
One of my favorites?
Or biggest, I don't know.
Barclay Perkins Sparkling Beer.
Okay. Sparkling beer. Well, I don't even know what sparkling beer is, actually.
It's incredibly vague. I didn't used to know what it was until I found the brewing records. I'd seen it mentioned, and I assumed, based on the color and the strength, that it was some sort of pale ale. Then I find out, it was brewed in that lager brewery, and it's actually a lager. And it's this thing that they mostly had for ship stores and the British military. So it's this weird thing. If you're going to define it, you'd probably have to say it was a Vienna lager because it's like an amber bottom fermenting beer, but it's pretty weird. And it was one of the earliest canned beers. I found some great photos on the internet where some people had stumbled across this British camp from World War II way out in the Libyan desert. And there were like these empty packs of fags and these cans of Barclay Perkins sparkling beer. Well, obviously empty.
Interesting. Sparkling beer, huh? And what made it different? What was different about the recipe?
It's a bit weird. It's sort of got like dark malt and crystal malt. It's just an odd beer. And one I sort of struggled to say, I wouldn't really want to classify it. So it's just strange. Well, I mean, I'm really pleased because I got to taste it in the St. Louis Historic Lager Festival, which is one of my dreams come true.
Interesting.
Did you hear about that?
No, I don't know anything about it. Tell us about it.
Well, this was at Urban Chestnut. We had I'd been trying to get this organized for years, a festival just of historic lager beers. And so we had this in April, I think it was, this year, Urban Chestnut in St. Louis. It was really brilliant, especially because they had several Barclay Perkins beers on, one of which was sparkling beer. And I'd provided most of the recipes, which is obviously why the Barclay Perkins one was there. But it was a really fun event. I think I'd deliberately designed the recipes to try and open people's minds a bit about what lager is. Mm-hmm. It's not just pale, weak and fizzy, that there's a whole other world of lager out there if people want to look at it.
Awesome. Well, we're coming to the end here, but the mini book's one of many volumes you've done, and I'm going to bring up your website here, which is Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, which is at barclayperkins.blogspot.com. And where can folks get your book? Where can they read more? I guess probably at the blog, right?
Yeah, if they go to the blog, there's links to buy my books. It's I've got lots of them. Or they go to Lulu. Just look up me, Ron Pattins, and you'll come up with my stuff. There's not many people with my name, thankfully.
And what periods have you covered with some of your other books?
Well, I've done the interwar period, so the 20s and 30s. I've got a book about that. My next book, which is three quarters finished, is about World War One, which I'm hoping to have finished in time for November, so I can, seeing as it's called Armistice, I think it would be nice if I had it ready for November, but I'm going to have to get on with that. A lot of the things I've done have been style-based rather than particularly period-based. So, I mean, this book is actually one chapter of the book that I was originally very grandiosely wanted to write, which was about British beer from 1700 to 1973. And this is effectively the last chapter of that book.
So it's you're writing the book, but in multiple volumes, apparently, right?
Well, I've got this crazy large manuscript of a 250,000 words somewhere, and occasionally I rip bits out of it and stick somewhere else. But yeah, so I can imagine how big it's going to be because this was one of the shorter chapters, and it's 350
like
pages.
I'm thinking like a 10-volume set or something, right?
Yeah, I might get through it by the time I die if I manage to keep my health till I'm 90.
So that, and then of course you write on a regular basis at your blog, right?
Well, every day.
Every day, wow.
Yeah, I've posted every day for 10 years.
That's impressive. A huge amount of information there. And again, I'll just put the blog up. It's Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, which you can easily find on Google. Well, Ron, thank you. Thank you again for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed having you.
Well, it's always fun. It's always nice to have a chance to talk about beer with no one interrupting me.
Yep. Very enjoyable. Again, my guest today was the one and only Ron Pattinson, historical beer author. You can find out more about his blog, about his books, and of course, his daily blogging at, I'm going to bring it up, Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, which is barclayperkins.blogspot.com. Thank you again, Ron.
Well, thank you.
Well, a big thank you to Ron Pattinson for joining me this week. Thanks also to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the Beersmith Cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available for download for both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.